Can I then invite Rod Swift from the Gay and Lesbian Equality?
How do you see the number of roles?
It's always best to get as many hats on as possible and try and separate them in your private life. And I'd like to thank you both, commissioners, for allowing you to have such a generous 40 minutes today to hopefully explore some of the issues that we've raised in both our state-focused paper, which I've left in my bag, and our national submission.
Yes. You might just, at your opening, identify the relationship of the two bodies that you're speaking for today and your role with them.
Certainly. In regards to a state-based level here in Western Australia, I'm convener of Gay and Lesbian Equality WA, which is our state-based human rights group for GLBTI people, and who were assisted with the instrumental reforms in the lead-up to and past 2001. That's that particular role. The other role I happen to have as a hat is Secretary of the Australian Coalition for Equality, which is a new national body that has been formed by a network of GLBTI human rights advocates with a history of law reform achievement across the states. And we have representatives from virtually every state, not all the territories, but every state in that particular group. And that's basically a response to the way that GLBTI rights had not been dealt with, as former Senator Brian Goode pointed out, had not been dealt with in a really efficient way or an effective way at federal level. As Brian pointed out, a lot of reforms have been achieved on a state-based level, and because of the tyranny of distance, not much in a federal sphere, sadly. So ACE came together to try and start the momentum moving on those particular law reforms as states sort of wind down in their law reforms, and primarily a large push inside ACE comes from Tasmania and Western Australia, where these reforms have been substantially achieved. In regards to the relationship between the two groups, previous bodies at a federal level, like the Australian Council of Lesbian and Gay Rights, which Brian used to be spokesperson for, failed, unfortunately, over time. They existed in the late 90s. And the primary reason for that is because the state-based groups that formed the federated-style council unfortunately distracted and work on their state-based issues, and that caused problems within a national-based organisation. So ACE as a national organisation is separated from state bodies for that reason, so that there can be a true concentration on the federal law reform ahead.
Thank you. Now, we have a very helpful submission from you, but I'm sure there are things that you would like to say to us expanding on that. Please feel free to.
Well, certainly, and thank you for that, Commissioner. The ACE submission, if I can actually start with that first, because it is the more substantive of the two submissions, and I want to come back to some specific state-based stuff, but also a bit of a crossover between the two. Now, the ACE submission does try and enumerate a lot of areas of the law that are currently discriminant, and I'm sure that your hearings, both prior to this one in Sydney and the subsequent ones, will have many, many stories of the discrimination people face. And it is disappointing, by the way, that from a personal level, the federal government has disallowed their departments from providing the information about the laws that are discriminant. I find that to be making our job a bit more difficult as well, and your job in the inquiry. But we touched on some of the areas of federal law that that have this discrimination, from things through superannuation and defence and veterans affairs, and through to medical, aged care, and social security, which are the big ticket items we see that are discriminant. And as Brian mentioned earlier, it has been very, very lacklustre, the performance of the federal government in reforming these areas of law, and that if there is reforms that have been done, they've either been politically expedient reforms, for example, the same-sex couples being able to claim death benefits from accumulation-style schemes without taxation penalty, as a trade-off for the bans in the Marriage Act to same-sex couples, or have been areas of policy change, not legislative, like defence changes recently that occurred in December of last year, where the ADF changed their standing policies because they had the empowerment to do so, and to reform those particular areas of the law, in part because naturally there are some legislative areas they cannot amend that would require federal parliament. So we've pretty much gone through those particular areas and tried to enumerate them for the commission to help out in this inquiry. I have highlighted a whole heap of passages that I want to sort of bring to the Commission's attention, and sort of like put in the perspective of where Gail's submission comes into it as well. And that is that when we look at all of these issues, whether it's Medicare or defence or whatever, it comes down to the fact that, as Brian quite correctly pointed out, same-sex couples are put into this category of, as he called it, a third-class category of interdependency or other partner or other relationship, and that there's this hierarchy between married couples, firstly, heterosexual de facto couples, secondly, and then everyone else in the boat, which is thirdly. This permeates all the areas of the law that we're looking at that are discriminant. For example, in defence, we have the situation where the Defence Department's policies, which are a relatively good move forward in regards to relocational allowances and things like that, use the term interdependency or trying to define interdependency, but it's different to the way the migration legislation and regulations define interdependency. And by not having a common definition, it opens up these particular loopholes and problems of law. And I actually want to bring in my own personal story here, although I didn't put in either of the submissions. But in 1991, one of my friends gave me a tarot card. The tarot card was Wheel of Fortune. And the reason why they gave me this card was that it was a work colleague. I mentioned to them that my relationship, which was actually an international relationship at the time, my partner was in the United States, was likely being a Wheel of Fortune. You could spin every day and get a different outcome. And at that time, we had the migration regulation stating you had to have 6 months cohabitancy. And you only realise how much your life is determined by fortunes, and Killian Sam actually mentioned fortunes, when you finally get that 6 months together, then the regulations change to make 12 months. We battled for 9 years to be together, and we couldn't, because we could never spend 12 months together. I had to quit jobs and travel all the time to make that relationship survive. We managed to spend 5 months together, but it would be 3 or 6 months at a time, and we never got there. If we had got there, we would have been put under the microscope of the Immigration Department to prove that relationship. They would have asked us why we don't have joint assets or a joint bank account. We actually did have a joint bank account, though, which was lucky at the end. But at the end of the day, one day, I stand up bankrupt on that Wheel of Fortune when the relationship finally ended. And it ended after 8.5 years of tyranny. And the reason why I still have that very same tarot card attached to my fridge door is every morning I wake up and I think, what is the Wheel of Fortune going to do me today? And luckily in WA it's not so bad, but I've lived in other states and it can be bad. And there's one thing I'd like to say, and I'm not going to quote from Martin Luther King or Coretta Scott King or fantastic people, but I think of my fridge door and I think that Wheel of Fortune. And one day I want to throw that card away, because no group of people in society ever, when it comes to their civil rights, should have their civil rights determined by a spin of a Wheel of Fortune. They should either be absolute or non-existent, in a way. And that is what is so terrible. And why I think that is at the heart of this inquiry is how do we eliminate people having to spin this terrible Wheel of Fortune every day. So I want to bring that into the equation, because it sort of like drives the solutions and suggestions that both Gail and Ace have made, and I know I want to put the Gail cap on, because one of the things that we've seen here in WA is if you can get a consistent, and also Tasmania mind you, is if you can get a consistent definition in law, and you mentioned this earlier, it makes problems go away. You don't have this Wheel of Fortune you have to spin. And you can hear the relief of Kelly and Sam when they say that when it comes to them wanting to have a family and have their relationship recognised, they have this great relief they live in this state, because suddenly they've got certainty and not fortunes to have to rely on. And that is where I'd hope the Commission would find eventually in the report, is that these fortunes have to disappear. These random spins have to disappear. And somehow ending up bankrupt have to disappear, because there is a great financial toll. The way we would see that that could be done effectively and deals with all of these areas is to have a common and consistent cross-jurisdictional definition of a de facto relationship. Alternatively, and quite separately, that the Marriage Act could be amended. There are advantages of both. I noticed that you asked of Gis Watson earlier, had there been any moves in the state to set up a registration or certification scheme for same-sex couples in the state. And that would be a fantastic thing, just as it's been done in Tasmania, and we would fully support it. In fact, we've been pushing for it, and only recently, as last weekend, the National Party in the state was supporting it as well. And in fact, I still have the TV footage on my computer at home of an 84-year-old woman saying that about this homosexual nonsense, these people are born this way, why don't you just deal with it and get on with it? And when you hear that, you're hearing somebody from the opposite side of the coin, the straight world, saying, why do we let these people deal with this wheel of fortune? That is one good thing, and I believe that all states should be encouraged to move along the path to have de facto laws that allow a certification and registration scheme. The way we propose it here, though, might be of interest to the Commission, and that is that, as Gis described in her oral evidence today, the state-based de facto laws have a certain number of indicators about them as to what exists for a relationship. Generally it's 2 years, generally it's cohabitation, generally it's financial dependency, social status and understanding of the relationship by others and things of such nature. Not all of those factors have to be there. We proposed a very, very simple alternative to that for a very specific reason, because de facto couples should exist de facto, of course, after certain periods of time, and that should remain on the books. But we suggested a second way of, and that's a very, very simple way, of allowing such a registration scheme to exist to provide the exact same benefits, would be to add a new clause to the Interpretation Act, where it defines de facto, to state that a certificate issued by the Registrar of Births, Deaths and Marriages shall be prima facie evidence that a relationship exists, therefore allowing people to opt in to a de facto relationship and then amending the Births, Deaths and Marriages Act accordingly to create that register. And that would be fantastic for some of the same-sex couples that slip through the cracks when we think about the de facto definition. People who don't live together generally, or international couples. For example, in the case where I was maybe 15 years ago, it would be doubtful that my partner and I, having such a non-fixed address type of relationship, would count as a de facto relationship. But there's also what I call functional equality with marriage, and there's a huge debate about that at the moment, of course, and that is that if same-sex couples can't have access to the Marriage Act, and they only have access to state-based de facto recognition at this stage, same-sex couples should be able to, as well as opposite-sex couples, if they don't believe in marriage, should be able to access a scheme where they can instantly and immediately register a relationship, you know, fully well knowing the intent of doing so, as a married couple would, and that can, of course, help out in very, very specific situations. For example, I know of one girl here in WA, a young girl, relatively, she's a young adult. It's scary when you get to midlife like I am, and I'm thinking there are now young people and men, who was sick and diagnosed with a terminal illness, and luckily she's going okay, but in that situation, she might want to think about, we don't think about these things when we get into the most terrible situations, but think about how she protects her family and relationship and make sure that after she might pass on, that her wishes and respects and her relationship are taken care of. If she had access to a civil union or a registration scheme, there would be no doubt to government or business as to the status of that relationship. That is one way forward, and I'd encourage all the states to go that way. Disappointingly, though, of course, we still have the issue of federal-state relations, and as it was I guess as well, who said that the standing committees of Attorney General have dealt with this issue time and time again, and it seems to have gone nowhere on the agenda. And that is, how do we deal with the cross-jurisdictional issues and also the federal issues of recognising relationships? Now, we know the federal government won't touch marriage. They don't want same-sex couples to have marriage. But equally, if they're going to allow that, one could argue that they should be recognising what states believe are de facto relationships. Because they do that for same-sex couples, for opposite-sex couples. If you're an opposite-sex couple and generally in a de facto relationship in the state, you're generally de facto in a federal sense. There's not much disagreement there. This is where, no matter what the states may do, and if they, say, adopted the model of having a registrational certificate scheme, there needs to be a way of also then having those being able to be interchanged and recognised by other jurisdictions, including the federal government. And this may also assist the federal government in actually not having to deal with the issue of interdependency. Kelly Sam described having a dream, and that would be my dream, is to one day not have to spin the wheel of fortune and change states. Also, if we had a state-based registration scheme across all the states in each state jurisdiction, it may resolve some of these issues, as mentioned by Brian earlier, as to how we determine whether a relationship is existent for, say, for example, defence relocation, the issues of cohabitation there. Because all those issues go out the door when we have a common and standard definition. And that would take away much of the uncertainty that GLBTI couples have. So that's basically, if I could say anything, a nutshell, overarching summary of the Gale submission, and also, in a way, the ACE submission, because each of them have, at the core of their submissions, the same thing, which is a common cross-jurisdictional definition to make sure all these problems go away.
Well, thank you very much, particularly your observations as to how we might address the problem, how the Parliament might address the problem. Thank you.
So, have you got any issues you
would
like to raise?
Speaking for myself, I found that so comprehensive I haven't actually got any questions.
I was going to say, I have a few more points at the end too, which...
Well, I
wrote them on the back and I should have got some.
I'm in a bit the same position. I'm going through my questions, but I think you've covered them off. You talked about, you suggest that we review the substantive findings of the Senate Committee's inquiry into sexuality discrimination. Can you point us to the findings and recommendations that you think are particularly important?
That one's got them in the hot
button. That's in the Gale submission.
That's right, it's in the Gale submission. The reason why we included that in there in our submission briefly was that we noted that the Senate had conducted very full inquiries in regards to what was then the Sid Spindler's sexuality bill. There we go, I'll trip over it again. Which was, of course, a private member's bill introduced into the Senate by the Democrats in 1996 and continued to be carried on the notice paper by Brian Greig. The reason why we pointed that is because we were possibly concerned that there would be non-cooperation from the federal government in regards to finding the areas of discriminatory law, and that areas would be missed out by people despite having 340 submissions. That the Senate might have some areas that might not be covered off by this particular inquiry or might not have been found. That's why we incorporated it there. So we weren't specifically pointing to a particular section or areas of that. We're just making note that there had been a lot of groundwork done in that particular inquiry.
Okay, thank you. Now, you've put a series of... I'm sorry.
That's fine. Can I go back to... You started me asking questions now.
That's okay.
Can I go back to the ACE submission?
Mm-hmm.
Which in the area of superannuation argues that the definition of interdependency is at odds with other federal legislation and state definitions.
That's right.
Could you, and you talked about some of the differences, but if you had to choose one of these definitions to be used across state and federal legislation, which would it be and why would you choose that?
Okay, if it came down to having a choice of all the models of how de facto is recognised or how interdependency is defined in federal law as well, we'd either look at the West Australian or the Tasmanian model, and the reasons why are quite separate. The West Australian model has some very unique quirks in it, I do encourage you to have a look at, if you can, the Interpretation Act in WA 1984, in which, and the primary reason why this is the best one in one regard, is that there's no requirement to have all of the stated indicators of a de facto relationship. So, for example, if cohabitation is a problem, and there are some people who have to live bona fide away from each other, or temporarily or permanently, or fly in, fly out, for example, especially in this state, that there are ways of having that take into account. So the West Australian definition is good in that regard, and some other states have that. They have the, you know, some but not all of these definitions in their de facto laws are required to be present, but not all, as I said, to improve a relationship. The reason why WA's laws are also very, very interesting is they deal with something that was sort of put through on the sly in a way. There is another clause in the WA definition which states that, and you'd be surprised by this, that, and it's actually quite practical, that a de facto relationship shall exist irrespective of whether either of the two people in the de facto relationship are in another relationship. And that's specifically for a number of reasons. There are a number of people, due to faith, who might not divorce, but yet form another relationship after that particular marriage is irreconcilable. And or may form another relationship while they're going through divorce proceedings. Our state law recognises that both may exist. They always recognise them as a case of two pairs rather than a group relationship or polygamy, but there is the ability for the existence of a relationship to not be hindered by a prior relationship possibly still existing. So that's one benefit of that particular definition. And quirky as it is, but I don't know how many people in the census form put down that one in multiple relationships, but technically you can have them in this state, and it's multiple relationships by pairs. Scary. The Tasmanian model, again, this steps one step further, broader. The Tasmanian Relationship Register deals with close personal relationships that aren't same-sex couple relationships necessarily. They could be cohabiting relatives. They could be any type of close personal relationship. There are advantages in the Tasmanian model because one could argue that some of the benefits that are given out at a federal level, again, this is probably outside of the scope of this inquiry, but some of the benefits we might give at federal level, say, for example, to passing the superannuation rights, etc., etc. You might have, for example, I'll throw an example, an elderly woman who might be aunt of a young girls that she might be taking care of and might want to pass superannuation benefits without having to pay a death benefit to that particular family member, or elderly people just living together, things like that. So the Tasmanian model or definition has advantages because it's broader in scope and recognises other relationships. And that's actually where the federal government starts to put interdependency, or where they shove same-sex couples into interdependency, because they say, well, same-sex couples can be treated under migration legislation, for example, as independent, like an aunt and a niece or nephew would in their relationships. And so there are two ways of actually dealing with this, and it is very, very much, as Brian said, a problematic definition of interdependency, and it really does hark back to the early 90s when the migration legislation was amended. It's not a perfect definition. It is, for some people, very much an insulting definition, a marginalising definition. And there are good ways in the Tasmanian legislation of making sure that all relationships of a close personal nature are better defined and more palatable.
Thank you. Superannuation question now. You suggest in the A submission that the 2005 Superannuation Legislation Amendment Act permits the family court to divide superannuation on the breakdown of heterosexual relationships only. Are you aware of anyone that has attempted to claim this split when their relationship ended in a same-sex relationship?
No, I'm not aware of anyone who's tried to claim it, mostly because they've been advised that statutorily it will not succeed. Also, and this is pointed out by Giz, there is a very, very strange situation in WA as well, being the nirvana somewhat of same-sex couples like Tasmania. and actually Tasmania, we're ahead of Tasmania in one respect, and that's having our own family court system.
Yes.
We haven't chosen to refer power to the Commonwealth in regards to that, specifically because of same-sex couples. One of the things we are fearful in the state is that if there might be a change of government, they might refer those powers and we'd lose out some of our rights to buy property in an appropriate court system rather than the Supreme Court. But at the end of the day, same-sex couples in other states, for example, who would be forced to use their Supreme Court system to divide their property assets, that Supreme Court would not be able to divide superannuation funds held by each person fairly. So if there is an inequity between the two partners, let's say, for example, one works, one doesn't, therefore one has accumulated quite a number of superannuation assets and the other one not, those couples would not be able to, unlike heterosexual couples, either married or de facto, would not be able to have a fair apportionment of those particular accumulated assets.
But you were suggesting in your submission that, that is happening without the assistance of the court. Can you explain the process by which same-sex couples go about doing that?
I actually don't think we did. Hold on, just quickly read. Superannuation spending rules.
Maybe I've misread.
It says we were ignored as the federal government did not amend relevant parts of the Family Law Act to allow, despite the government being given a referral of powers. That's right, so the states have, this is actually very good, thank you, now I know why I highlighted it. The states have actually referred the power for division of, whenever we come up, sorry, should I go back a bit, whenever it comes to de facto couples separating property, whether it be heterosexual or not, the federal government always had to go and collect a referral power from the states for this. And I know from some WA experience, the WA government passed two sections, one to refer heterosexual and one to refer gay couples of this particular splitting ability. The federal government's chosen only to accept the referral of heterosexual couples into their jurisdiction, and that's because they're not amending the Family Law Act. So they have the ability to, but they've chosen not to legislate in that area in regards to this particular matter.
With the division of property in Western Australia between same-sex people who split up, you've mentioned that it goes to the Supreme Court?
No, it goes to our WA Family Court.
That's what I thought.
In other states, however, they had no option but to go to their Supreme Courts, and in fact Tasmania is having a debate about that because, again, their state government has recently proposed new legislation to refer powers, and again, they're only referring the powers for heterosexual couples. Some states only refer the power for heterosexual couples only because they know the federal government won't accept same-sex couple referrals.
Thank you. Can I go to defence now, Defence and Veterans Affairs? In your submission, again, the A submission, you talk about in 2005 there were changes to some internal Defence Force policies which allowed same-sex couples and others in close personal relationships to access benefits in the same way as heterosexual couples. Could you describe the changes that occurred and tell us or point us to where we can find copies of these policies?
Certainly, and I'm quite happy to provide a copy of it to the Commission by email. It was actually a defence signal, so it was an active signal sent to all ADF personnel, basically, using their notification system, so like an internal memo, stating that the ADF had changed its policies and would recognise for various policies which it can administer, things like relocation allowances and the like, to include same-sex couples. They also then went on to define what a same-sex couple was, and that included cohabitation, etc., so it was very much like an interdependency division. Interdependency definition, and that basically was issued, I believe, in October or November last year, which and also came into effect on December 1. That was basically the substance of that signal. Again, we've heard from I don't know if you've received a submission from a group called DEFLIS, which is the defence. Gay and Lesbian Information Service, which is the group for people serving in our armed forces who happen to be gay or lesbian.
I don't remember it.
No.
They have reported ad hoc there are still some problems with that particular definition, specifically that we have a very mobile workforce in the military. Sometimes, and I'll give an example, It's great if a partner is relocating with the same-sex partner, but if, for example, the non-military partner has work in a particular city, let's say, for example, Cairns, and they get relocated to a different defence base, let's say Perth, if the person who's in full-time employment outside the military can't move immediately, there could be problems because they suddenly become non-cohabiting when the defence personnel member has to move. And there are questions as to whether they could actually be then paid for to move at a later point, and at how long after that particular defence service member's move will the Defence Department pay for relocation of the non-defence member, for example. Also for one particular couple I've heard of, one's currently serving actively in Iraq or Afghanistan, one of the two, and they're worried that, again, some of these benefits that are payable are only when cohabiting, and there are questions as to whether they're cohabiting while one's on active service, and things like this. And this is where some of the, again, it comes back to that question I asked earlier, Commissioners, about definitions. Having some hard defined definitions like cohabitation in the definitions of interdependency or even de facto at a state level provides some inflexibility that don't help relationships being recognised at a state or federal level.
Those difficulties you've just mentioned in the Defence Force too would apply equally to de facto heterosexual couples from that point.
I'm not sure, because the Defence Signal was a new definition of interdependency that was put in. I don't know what their policy is for de facto and whether cohabitation is required. I'd have to check up on that.
Behind the Defence Force Signal lies a regulation made by the Minister of Defence, the Defence Force pay determination, which was changed after some year or so by Herriot working on the Ministry of Defence. So there's a regulation that's made by the Minister. It's a pay determination, very similar to the determinations made by the Remunerations Tribunal in that case by the Minister.
And I mean, that would be one area that would be of interest, I think, to us, is that is there a way of also allowing such things like statutory tribunals that deal with things like Commonwealth pay and conditions having to review their definitions of de facto or intimate relationships, because again, if they've got issues like, as Brian mentioned, a staff member who happens to also be a family member, of course they spin on that wonderful wheel of fortune, is there a way of making sure that certain issues like, for example, cohabitation are dealt with flexibly, and having a, as I mentioned earlier, a model like Western Australia or Tasmania, where all of these things might exist, but not all of them have to exist, would be a much better way of moving forward.
I think our understanding generally is that within workplace agreements and industrial conditions, within virtually the whole of the public service, same-sex relationships, insofar as they can be dealt with at that level, have been appropriately dealt with. The problem is where you have an actual piece of legislation, a statute that's dealing with the topic, and then you have to, of course, go beyond the department and get the Parliament to change the definition.
Yes, spans and works, they usually don't mix.
Can I ask about one more area of your submission? It's medical and aged care. A number of organisations and individuals have raised the issue of the Medicare Safety Net with us, and we expected that this would be an issue that was raised. The ACE submission mentions that there are actually two safety nets, one for out-of-pocket medical expenses and one for the gap between the cost of a medical service and the Medicare schedule fee. Right. You say in your submission, as I understand it, that heterosexual couples are able to combine their health expenses to reach the thresholds, but same-sex couples aren't. So could you provide an example of the costs faced by a same-sex couple in comparison to a heterosexual couple, and you might want to take this on notice, in reaching both safety net limits, because I'm trying to get my head around the impact of the two safety net limits and the disadvantage or discrimination faced by same-sex couples.
Certainly. I can certainly give you an example of how the discrimination works and up to how much it would cost per annum. And I'll take the example of Kelly and Sam, which I quite know well, and maybe 5 years down the track if they have a child. Basically, the Act, the Health Insurance Act, the National Health Act, specifically defined for the pharmaceutical benefits scheme and Medicare, these safety nets that allow people to minimise their expenses after they reach certain threshold points. Now, those threshold points are set whether somebody's on a government benefit or not, or the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. But generally, I think it's around about a couple of $100 in that particular safety net. If we were taking a heterosexual couple in the same situation, for example, husband and wife and one child, all three people will be counted to one safety net. And therefore, once reaching that safety net, all three people will be covered by that protected benefit of having their pharmaceuticals reduced to the discounted rate, which I think is around about, what, $5 or $6 per prescription rather than, I think, of around the $25 mark for a standard prescription. So if we take the situation of Kelly and Sam with one child, we firstly spin the wheel of fortune, if we can put it that way, to find out which child gets linked with which parent, in the hope that one would be covered, or that the child would be covered by the person who reaches a safety net first, if they're playing that particular case of the wheel. But they'd have two, basically, for all of them to be covered, they'd have to reach a safety net twice. One as an individual and the other one plus child as a family, ironically. But the net net detriment to them is that they could have potentially up to $600 or $700 worth of prescription costs that for one person who doesn't reach that or has to reach that safety and has to pay to get there to be fully protected. But also, it is detrimental to the individual with child grouping because they can't use the other person to get to the safety net as quick. So it means only two people can provide into the accumulation of the expense to get to that safety net. Same thing happens in the Medicare one, which is, I think, about $1,000 now. They've just raised it from about $700 to $1,000 for non-benefit recipients. Again, the same sort of situation applies. The child would be apportioned to, and they'd have to guess which person's going to hit the benefit first, or benefit limit first, to try and get them covered. And the same sort of discrimination applies. Again, they can't all provide into one grouping, they're separated into two, and it makes the job that's so much more difficult to get there. And in this particular case, it'll be around about $1,000 of expense extra, potentially, that they have to spend to have everyone covered by both safety nets that apply. The two safety nets that have been set up for that one family.
Your examples are related to families. Is it fair to say that this is mainly going to be a problem where a same-sex couple have a child or children?
No, it's also affecting individuals. If you take the same situation for a couple with no children, it's exactly the same. A heterosexual couple is deemed as one family grouping for PBS and Medicare. For a same-sex couple, they are two individuals, and each individually have to meet their safety nets. Yeah.
So you just use children because of
medical
expenses.
It also shows the lotto that sort of exists of having to apportion, the children or child children with one of the two parents. And if you get the wrong parent in the grouping, if it's the other parent who gets saved in the first, then there could be, the detriment not, what I'm trying to express is the detriment might not be the one individual hived off. It could actually be the remaining group. Yeah. The individual might reach the safety net all by themselves.
I'm sorry, I did promise you this was my last question, but I have actually found out more than one of those.
That's okay.
It's aged care, Act.
And I had a point about aged care too, so that's good.
Okay. Doesn't recognise same-sex couples as couples or partners under the legislation, is what you say. And this means that a person in a same-sex relationship will receive less financial assistance under the residential care subsidy scheme. Can you explain how that scheme works, and do you have an example of the financial impact that this has on same-sex couples in terms of the amount of financial assistance received under the residential care subsidy scheme?
Now, that one I will have to take on notice, unfortunately, because I'm not an expert on that one. But I did actually miss something out in this particular submission, and in fact somebody else prepared this part of the submission. That's why I'm a bit not up to scratch on it. I do apologise. But I can give an example of one area that might have been missed by other people in this in their submissions, and that is the way same-sex couples are treated as, again, individuals when it comes to entry into aged care and nursing homes. Specifically, that de facto heterosexual couples and married couples if they have, for example, joint assets like a house. If one person is being admitted into a nursing home, the other one is staying at home, they don't have to sell the family home to pay for nursing home bonds. That's not the case for a same-sex couple. If they have, even as Brian said, housing as tenants in common, they're still treated as individuals for that particular law and would have to sell one half of the house to raise the bond.
Yeah.
And more importantly, it would be the other partner trying to buy the other half of the house.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's just a huge, especially with housing prices, a huge financial burden on same-sex couples to start with. The second thing we also raised in that part of the submission was that that the Council of Ageing and also the National Seniors Association fully and strongly support keeping same-sex couples who are elderly together in nursing home accommodation, and we're most concerned that that hasn't been addressed yet.
When you address that aged care question that I asked, if you could you also comment on the role of the Code of Practice for Residential Aged Care and how that addresses same-sex couples in terms of currently being able to remain together if they enter aged care, because I think that's an issue that we'd still be interested in some further submissions on.
Certainly, and if I can ask also of you, Commissioners, have you received a submission from the Gay and Lesbian Retirement Association?
We're meeting
with them at the forum. Fantastic, because they'll be able to provide all these and many answers to that. They are fantastic experts in this particular matter.
Right, I'm sorry for someone who only had one short question.
Now, Rod, I think you said you found some notes on the back of your submission that you wanted to add.
Most definitely, and it's specifically state-based stuff, which is good, in a way. And so, like, crossing off some of the stuff that's covered by Giz after Brian spoke. Just looking quickly through this here. Oh, yes, you asked the question of Giz Watson as to whether all the areas of state law have been amended. Just for the record, there is one area that hasn't been amended, and that is the Evidence Act. It was one that they missed, so we're still working on that. We're hoping for a subsequent amendment sometime soon. You asked a question in regards to...
What is the point under the Evidence Act?
Apparently it's in relation to... people being compelled to give evidence against their partner. I think that has not been amended at this stage. I think that is what it's about. I'll have to go and check my notes. You asked a couple of questions in regards to the prevalence of adoption and IVF services in the state, and I think I might be able to provide them some more information about that. And Kelly and Sam provided some information. There is only around 6 to 7 children that are up for what is known as stranger adoption, as we call it, as opposed to known adoption, per annum. And they were sort of right. They are one of... Kids mentioned there's one couple that's been approved, which is a male couple, in the last 2 or 3 years. And they do stand as one couple among about 120 approved that year. There's actually around about 120 people joining that particular... a pool of potential suitable parents. It's not just that there's a waiting list of just 120, so there's actually quite many more. More importantly, though, one aspect that was forgotten in this particular situation is that the relinquishing parents under WA's laws have the ability to have effectively a veto right as to which couples might have their adopted relinquished child adopted to them, which also significantly slims the odds. Again, that was a politically pragmatic viewpoint at the time, and I think somewhat still justifiable that a relinquishing parent or couple certainly should have the right to express a wish as to where their child might be placed in an adoptive service. But one of the things that I also want to mention was that foster care is the great forgotten family structure in Australia. We always think of natural born children and adopted children, but hardly ever the thousands of children in foster care. And I don't know if you've received many submissions in regards to foster care and how, again, the federal and state governments deal with same-sex couples that are fostering. I know of recent times there's been an absolutely desperate call, I think, in New South Wales for more foster parents, and they've been encouraging same-sex parents to register as foster parents. And we would suspect that the effect of federal law, and certainly laws in certain states, on the way families are treated would equally affect foster parenting and foster children in the same way, for example, Medicare safety nets and pharmaceutical benefit schemes and things like that. We didn't have time to investigate whether certain federal government family payments, for example, and state government payments to foster parents were discriminant in nature in regards to their payment to same-sex couples. Certainly we would flag that there are many, many more opportunities for same-sex couples to foster parent and adopt, and that we shouldn't forget them. Just thinking about the rest of my notes here. Mentioned the fact that we were suggesting a change of the Births, Deaths, and Marriages Act in WA. And also Killian Sam mentioned in passing but not in detail about the relationship that they had with their donor for their IVF and IUI and AI procedures for them trying to get pregnant. Want to actually elaborate on that a bit more. The laws here in WA are quite good in regards to this particular area. And this is just generally, if a person decides to donate genetic material to allow an IVF procedure to occur, from the male's perspective here, that form that they're talking about that person signs is actually them extinguishing their parenting claim rights over any child that they might be born of the procedure. That's very, very important. And Killian Sam mentioned that it's good in the state we have a safe environment in which to seek IVF and AI services to try and conceive a child. And then, of course, having them protected under the birth certificate by having both parents listed. Other states don't have that particular ability. Some states have had some law reform allowing that single women or lesbian couples are treated like single women to get IVF services. There are some people, though, that go outside of that system and choose to try and self-inseminate, for example. For those couples, they have severe problems in regards to determining parentage, and that may, of course, also frustrate their recognition in state and federal law, I would say, if they're being presumed to be the donor is the father and the birth mother is the mother, and the third person in that particular equation, the non-birth mother, or possibly even the non-birth father, if you're looking at that way in a surrogacy type of situation, being left out in the cold in regards to the child's survivorship and lineage. So that's another issue that is also very interesting, that again doesn't really affect WA but affects other states. Just trying to think if there was one other thing that I'm that's going to bring up, and I know it's vitally not important. Just trying to think what it was. No, it's gone from me, but I'm sure I can email it in.
Well, Rod, do feel free to send any more information that you think about afterwards. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.